My name's James Cridland, and this is Uncommon.
This podcast is brought to you by Neural Media. Are you an entrepreneur or marketer who needs help making podcasts, video, or animation? Perhaps you don't have time to manage a freelancer or the budget to deal with an agency. Well, Neural Media can help you with simple and affordable content creation, saving you time and money by taking away the pain of producing that content. To learn more, head to neural.com/media. That's neural.com/media. Play around with our pricing or request a callback directly. Listeners to the show receive a special discount by using the promo code UNCOMMON. Welcome to another episode of Uncommon. My name's Jordan Michaelides and I'm your host. In this episode, I have for you James Cridland. James is the founder of PodNews and Media.info. With an impressive career at leading organisations such as the BBC and Virgin Radio, he's clearly earned the title of radio futurologist. And I think, in my humble opinion, James is the hero we need and deserve in the podcasting and radio industry, delivering us goodness through his daily news and analytics. In this episode, we covered a lot, including starting out in radio, working for the BBC, how PodNews began, complexities in podcasting, the future and what it holds, and his five favourite non-musical sounds. If you like the episode, do leave us a rating in your favourite podcast app. Or if you want a shout out for reviews, leave us a review so we can find that as well by next Thursday. If you want to share with your friends, take a screenshot and post on your Instagram story, tagging us at @uncommon_show. To watch the episode or video in full, search Uncommon Show on YouTube. And of course, don't forget to like and subscribe. Show notes and all previous guests can be found at neural.com/podcasts. With that being said, guys, thanks for listening. I hope you'll enjoy this conversation with James Cridland. James, welcome. We're live. How are you?
I'm good. It's it's good to be in Melbourne. It's good to be reminded what clouds look like.
I know. What was it like when you flew down from Brisbane prior? It's always really... like, your winter there is like, what, 18 degrees or something like that?
Well, I mean, sometimes it goes down to 7. And 7 indoors is really cold, let me tell you. But you know, winter lasts for about a week. So yeah, it's kind of all right.
You don't get the wind chill that we have.
No.
So the wind chill is, I think, we get these sort of Arctic, sort of mistral type things that come through the south of the bay. And so, as an example, Lauren's parents live down on the peninsula. And down on the peninsula, there's all these little piers.
Oh, yes, it's cold down there.
It's very cold.
Oh, yes.
You go stand on a pier at, I don't know, dusk or something like that, and the wind starts to pick up and you can literally feel it through your bones.
I made the mistake of going on holiday on the peninsula it was last year, kind of springtime. That was a big mistake. Mm. It was properly cold down there.
Was it?
Yes.
Do you remember where you went to?
Oh,
Sorrento, no. Portsea, any of those ring a bell?
None of them. None of them, no.
I do love it down there. Look, I'm the type that I grew up in Victoria. My favourite memory is playing soccer in the cold in the Dandenong Mountains with the rain hitting my hands, which were numb, and then coming home and having a nice warm shower.
Nice.
So you can see why when we're chatting before in the kitchen, I love the UK because I love that sort of the green rolling fields, the cold, wild weather.
Yes.
All that sort of stuff that you'd come to expect from the UK as well.
Yes. You don't get too much of that in Brisbane, it has to be said, particularly this summer, which has been tremendously dry. I can't quite remember it raining properly.
Okay. It has been very dry, though.
It's been incredibly dry. Yeah. So I drove 2 hours yesterday north, and everything looked... It was a bit weird because it was raining, drizzling very slightly for a little bit of it yesterday. And it kind of reminded me of autumn in the UK in that everything was brown, but everything was brown for a different reason because there's been no water.
Yeah. And also that it's the equivalent of the end of your winter as well
in
Brisbane. So
indeed,
not a good thing.
No.
I got to ask, why Brisbane?
Oh, I met a girl.
Okay.
Yeah.
As all love stories begin.
As all love stories begin. Yes. And so we, when our daughter was born, we were there working out what to do for school. And, you know, the UK's got very good schools, but in London in particular, the school infrastructure hasn't necessarily kept pace with the amount of people who live there. And, you know, and obviously, you know, London's a busy, busy place. And we were thinking, well, you know, where would be best to bring our daughter up? And we decided that 10,000 miles the other side of the world was probably the best place.
Look, it's a fair point.
Which, to be honest, now, looking back, is probably a good thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course, there's the Brexit coming on. But
yes.
You've also just got to look at I feel like Australian life. I've worked in the finance sector for a while, or I had worked in the finance sector primarily. And obviously, working in that sector, a lot of British expats from the City of London and London come over here.
Yeah.
And you sort of really start to get an idea of what life is like in the UK. And, you know, I feel like it's very interesting seeing people who are naive to complain about life here. Like, life is very, very easy here. In London, it's super competitive. When you're talking about one of the biggest, most competitive cities in the world, there's something like 8 to 10 million people that live in Greater London,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I can totally understand why they all
want your seat on the tube in the morning.
So, exactly. Yes. And then they come out here and they think, wow, it's sunny. I get paid basically the same. Cost of living is relatively similar. Why don't I just stay here?
Mm.
And I can totally understand. I mean, people all speak English as well. That's also a good thing.
Yeah, to a point.
To a point, yeah. I can see why they wanted. I mean, the two guys that in particular I'm thinking about that I worked with, Dan and Tom, they were both from the UK, but they met girls that, like yourself, were Australian. And one was Swedish, but they seemed to love the lifestyle in Australia.
Yes.
And I don't blame them. But you were chatting before about growing up in the UK. You're from London yourself.
Yes.
Which part of London?
Well, I was born in Hammersmith.
Okay.
Obviously, I couldn't live in Hammersmith because I'm not made of money. So I ended up living in North London, very close to a place called Cock Foster's, which everybody knows where Cock Foster's is because you hear it mentioned on
the
train.
Tube, yeah.
Yes, all the time. And so I lived in a lovely little place called Southgate. Called because it was the south gate of the King's hunting grounds back in the 1600s. So, and it's, you know, a wonderful little place with its own tube station, which looks a bit like an alien has landed.
Really?
So I lived there for, 11, 12 years or so. It's a great place to live. If you're working in media, really, at the time at least, there was no option. You needed to live in London because that's where all of media was. It's becoming a bit less London-centric now, but that's certainly as it was. So I moved down there to work for a bunch of stations and a bunch of organisations.
Who was your team that you supported growing up as a kid? Your EPL team, or Premier League team?
Well, yes. I didn't really support one.
Okay.
I didn't really support one. I ended up for 1 year, again, for reasons of women, ended up following around Plymouth Argyle, who are definitely not in the Premier League, which was an experience. I think I preferred the beer in the pubs rather than the matches, but nevertheless, that's basically it. But yes, I'm one of these strange English people that doesn't really do sport.
Yeah.
And I know
sport
that, you know,
at all or certain sports?
Sport at all. So I know that, you know, here in Melbourne, you follow very strange sports in comparison to Brisbane and, you know, and all of that. So I appreciate that there's a massive difference down here as well, and that, you know, sport is what makes Melbourne go round.
Yeah. It's like living in Texas and not saying that you're a Christian.
Yes.
It really is.
Yes. So, and you know, one of my friends who now does a breakfast show down here, one of the first things that he ended up doing on his breakfast show was to work out
What's his team?
What is my team? What team am I going to support? And that's a great thing.
Whenever I meet new expats, immigrants, or Uber drivers, I always say to them, pick a team and pick it fast, because it's the question that you're going to get asked the most.
Yes.
It's
easy in terms of state of origin, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, state of origin. No one gives a shit about who wins. They just want it to. I think actually.
Oh no, we really care who wins.
In Victoria, we.
But
don't.
In Victoria, of course, you don't.
Yeah. No. But I think there's recently been like a bit of contingent of fans from Melbourne Storm who really want Queensland to win, because there's a lot of players from Queensland that play for Melbourne.
Yeah. Well. Yeah.
So there you go. What's sort of your earliest memory growing up in the UK?
Earliest memory? I was unaware it was one of those types of podcasts. earliest memory. One of the things that I remember relatively early on, apart from running into a barbecue, which is a very Australian thing to do, but okay. I ran into a barbecue when I was about 5 or 6 and was rushed to hospital with a great big burn. Excepting that, I remember getting my first radio.
Yes, the Kellogg's Frosties.
The Kellogg's Frosties radio. Yeah. Yes, you're a man who's done your research. So, actually saving up the money, saving up the vouchers from the side of my packets of Kellogg's Frosties. And then, you know, sending off for this tiny little plastic radio.
Okay.
One of my first memories was actually getting that thing back and starting to play around with it.
Was that... Do you think where the passion for radio really came from is that initial playing around sort of period? Like, how did you go from that to starting to work in FM radio, I guess?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I started, I was fascinated with the radio that I got. We used to listen to the radio whenever I was in the car being driven to school. Obviously, I wasn't driving to school. Being driven to school.
It'd be funny if you were there.
You know, there was Terry Wogan on Radio 2. And that was something that we listened to all the time. And I remember, you know, Margaret Thatcher becoming Prime Minister and hearing that on the radio with my dad in the car and on the BBC. And so, you know, listening to all of that, and I was there thinking, this is something that I really want to do. And so I ended up doing, my exams were physics, music, and politics. Physics, just in case I wanted to be a station engineer. Music, so I could understand the music side. And politics, in case I wanted to be a journalist. So you can see that there was clearly something there in terms of really wanting to be involved in the audio world.
Right. But I can see that physics background as well. Maybe that's sort of an element of, like, do you find you're a very conscientious person? Like, I would assume that reading your newsletters that you are, because you're very empirical and... You know, like if you post about something in the newsletter, you've often tested it yourself just for the sake of testing it and reporting back to the audience, which I find interesting.
Yeah, yeah. No, and it's something I try and do because actually, you know, at the end of the day, it's important to look behind, to not just report what somebody is saying in an RSS feed or whatever, but to actually understand it. And I think that's an important thing. And I think I'm very lucky in that I'm the only, you know, there are a few people who write about podcasts out there. I'm one of a few who actually podcast. So there are quite a lot of writers who've never podcasted in their life. And I think that that's an important thing to do. But I think also important is to actually, you know, try these things, play around with them, understand how they work, how they don't work, so that you actually have, even if you don't necessarily pass opinion, you do actually at least have some experience of how these things work.
Yeah. And then it's not just something that you would have grabbed from the copy of the PR release about X thing that's come out or this or that, which is another thing too that I see.
Yeah, and actually understanding what the story is really about. Because there's one thing that the PR people want to tell you, what the story is about, and then there's another thing which is actually, oh, well, hang on there. I'm very lucky that I don't have one big advertiser, and so the money comes from lots of supporters, and there either commercial supporters or personal supporters, and so therefore I don't have to worry about upsetting anybody. And it's very easy, I think, if you work in radio or you work in newspapers to go, well, we don't really want to upset, you know, Commonwealth Bank,
because
Commonwealth Bank spends, you know, millions of dollars in our advertising. And so therefore, we don't really want to upset them that much. And from my point of view, if I really, really, really upset, you know, whatever company, then I earn $50 less if they pull their supporting. So from my point of view, I think that allows me to be much more honest. And, you know, to give them their due, you know, I've broken a couple of stories which haven't been as positive to some companies as they would probably have wanted. And to give them their due, there hasn't been a single company that has said, right, well, you know, we're not supporting you anymore. So that's quite nice.
That's
to
a
see.
Good thing. I was literally about to ask that. Have you had many people pull out on that basis? And it sounds like, I think they understand what they're getting into when they sponsor your...
Yeah, I think they do. And you know, and I'm very careful to, you know, to explain what they're going to get out of it, you know, as well. But I think, you know, I mean, there was a point where fairly early on in the history of Pod News where I was writing about iHeart. And iHeart were doing something, and it was probably a big mistake of theirs, but they were doing something that was essentially meaning that every single page load of their website was counting as a podcast play as well in their stats. And so I looked at all of the technology behind it and went, wait a second, there's something really weird going on here. Contacted them for comment, blah, 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 eventually published a story. And I thought, well, I'll never get support from them. And within 3 months, they were a supporter.
Really?
And I thought, that is, you know, I mean, they've got, you know, that's a very grown-up thing to do.
Well, I think to your, I guess to give you a compliment, you are the anti-Dunning-Kruger effect, if that makes sense. I've never read something and thought, like, you seem very fair and reasonable, and you can tell that. I think just that empirical approach to things means that if someone sees something that they would ordinarily disagree with, they know based on past experience that you're probably being reasonable. Like, that you wouldn't read and go, well, that person's a fucking idiot. They have no idea what they're talking about. Because I've never, there's been multiple moments where I've read newsletters where I have, you know, a very specific knowledge in this area and thought, yeah, that's actually a fair point. So I guess having that approach has probably helped you in that regard.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of you to say. I think, you know, having worked in radio for 30 years, as I have now, and worked in the podcasting field sort of off and on since 2005, you know, I think that's quite useful to have that history and that knowledge, and be able to, what I try and do a lot is to put things into context and to actually explain who these people are, and to explain, because there are new people getting involved in podcasting every single day, to actually explain who these people are, why this story is important, is, I think, a very important thing as well.
Yeah.
And not just to have a look at whatever story is being spun by the PR people.
The context part is big, because a lot of people miss, a lot of reporters don't, I guess, frame it in the context, and framing is everything. You mentioned before about your early radio career. I was actually one of the few people who probably got down to the bit on your LinkedIn profile where you exclaimed that, frankly, you shouldn't be reading this, which is, I thought was quite funny. Spoken about that initial love for radio. I know that it seemed you work at Pulse FM, which I've finally dug into who was the former colleague that you worked with that committed that murder, which was...
Oh, right. Okay.
I found them. It was... I mean, that could be a true crime podcast show, unfortunately.
It is one of my go-to things to warm an audience up is to point out, here is a photograph of me on a radio station, and there's a really important and really good DJ who has moved on to do all kinds of other things, and there's somebody who's in prison for killing somebody.
It really disarms the audience.
And then I just sort of pass on, and it's fun to do, yes. But came as a surprise.
How did you land that first job?
Oh, well, So I was really keen to work in radio, in some form of radio, and I, you know, having had that conversation about not interested in sport whatsoever, of course, the first thing that I did is I wrote to the radio station and I said, is there any chance that I can just come in and help? I'd just love to help. Please let me help. And so I came into the radio station for a week to help in their newsroom, which was essentially, you know, taking bits of tape and erasing it. And, you know, really tedious, you know, low-level work like that.
So they could reuse the tape and whatnot.
Yeah, so they could reuse the tape and all of that. And my so technically the first job that I did at a radio station is I carried the mobile phone for one of our reporters. And they were really, really big mobile phones at the point. So that, you know, shows you two things. Firstly, how technology has changed, and secondly, they had reporters that would actually go out of the radio station, which was, you know, which is an amazement now. But anyway, so you've got that side, and then I ended up working for the sports editor who saw me that week. Needed an extra pair of hands to work on his sports show on a Saturday afternoon.
Okay.
And so there I was, and I started working on the sports show, essentially, you know, recording stuff from the reporters that we had out in the field, reporting stuff that came up from a line in London, running into the studio, and doing all of that for a couple of years, earning nothing, but really enjoying it. And so, yeah.
And your first paying job was probably at Pulse FM, right?
Yeah, and so my first paying job was writing radio commercials.
That's right.
Which I've actually done for about 7 years. But that was writing radio commercials for a couple of years for that station, and going out and seeing clients and, you know, writing the spots that people hear.
Do you, we were chatting about this in the kitchen earlier, do you still have any of those old ads recorded at all? Like on tape or anything?
I don't. I mean, one of the things that I did that I'm surprised that I never did is I never recorded any of the ads. I was then on the radio for 2 years. I never recorded any of that.
Really?
So I have no tapes of me on the radio.
So they didn't default... I guess, yeah, I default mean they did, record.
They did but, record everything, but yeah. they recorded everything to the legal requirement, which was 60 days, and then everything was deleted and moved on. So I have no recordings. And so every so often, really weirdly, recordings appear on the internet. And so there was a little recording that I heard. There's a Twitter handle that just posts old bits of radio, and he clearly lives in West Yorkshire. And every so often, you know, you get this weird clip of, you know, some promo that I did promoting West Yorkshire's new official countdown. and I'm there going, I do not remember this at all.
What's the name of this handle? I've got to find it.
I've gotten... I'm
you have to forward it to me
think.
Later.
Yeah, I'm trying to think.
Because we were talking about this historical footage and radio stuff earlier, and another one of my favourite ones is there's a Twitter handle... can never remember his name until he makes a post, which is one every month or something like that. And I so infrequently go on Twitter these days that it's the first thing that comes up. And it's old footage of the UK sort of like 30s, 40s era type stuff. Mm. And he's colorized it. So it was all black and white footage. Yeah. I feel like he works at the BBC. He's pretty well.
Probably. There are 20,000 of them.
Yeah. It'd have to be. If to get that sort of that film and whatnot, that'd have to be. Yeah. Anyway, it must be fun seeing that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean it's tremendous because you know I've got no I've got a couple of photo shoots and things like that, but I've got no recordings of me at all, and so it's really weird seeing them and really weird hearing my voice, and you know, and it's a voice of somebody 30 years ago, you know, and it's a very different sound, and yeah, it's a very strange thing.
How's your accent changed since then?
My accent hasn't changed. I noticed that my radio voice had clearly changed a bit in that, you know, I was very much more shouty than I am now. And
Pulse FM live.
A bit more what's the word, a bit more sort of, you know, you got this sort of feeling that it was a little bit more transatlantic in phrasing, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But that was what radio was like in those days.
But
I mean, it was a wonderful place to work, a wonderful, I mean, I think we kind of, you know, it's difficult to look now, and you have all of the research behind media now, and you know that really you can talk for about 18 seconds, and that's the limit of a presenter break now. And you know, and there are all of these formats in terms of this crunch and roll, which is a format where you're only allowed to talk over the intros of songs, and you know, and all this kind of stuff. Back then, there was so much more, you know, freedom to do whatever it is that you wanted to. To the point where when I was first in that radio studio, I didn't have a list of songs to play. It was up to me to work out what songs I wanted to play. Which is, you know, I mean, if you talk to most radio presenters now who are working for the big commercial stations, they go, well, you know, that's never been the case. You know, it was a tremendous thing. And I think, you know, we kind of forget just the amount of freedom that we had, and the fact that there we were a radio station broadcasting to 1.2 million people, which isn't actually that big in the UK, but you know, still a sizable amount of people, and you know, and they left somebody like me in charge of a radio station for 4 hours. You know, I wasn't even 20.
What, you know? What segment did you do? Do you remember?
So I did. I did Drive Time for a year.
Oh, wow.
And then the guy that did evenings was sacked, and I ended up doing evenings.
Okay.
When I then moved to Sheffield and worked there, I did Sunday Breakfast and Swing. So Swing is when you're doing stuff for other people when they go on holiday.
Uh-huh.
So I did pretty well every shift on Hallam.
Wow.
And most of the shifts on Magic, which was the AM service.
Do you think there was a lot more channels back then?
No, there were far fewer radio stations, which was great, because that actually meant that the mediocre would still be listened to. But there was also much less networking. So as one example, I worked wrote radio commercials at a station called Viking in Hull. Yeah. And so Viking was a massive powerhouse radio station. It was on 24 hours a day. 24 hours a day, human beings were in that building doing shows on that radio station. Now, when you have a look at that radio station, it does one local breakfast show. That's it. Everything else is coming from somewhere else. And they've just made the decision, the owners of that station, they've made the decision that, well, there's no point in keeping a studio going here. We're going to close the entire radio station down, and Viking will still have a local breakfast show, but it will be a local breakfast show piped in from studios an hour and a half down the motorway.
What's the point?
Well, you know, I mean, you kind of do ask yourself, what's the point? But what a change. What a change from being something that was you felt proudly local about, to something where even the breakfast show, the Viking FM breakfast show, is coming from Sheffield, you know.
So it's mirroring what really has happened in the industry writ large, like publishing in general. I mean,
yeah, publishing in general, you can look at the US, which has happened in much the same way. You can look at, you know, I mean, radio here in Australia has done mostly that. So you listen to either the ABC or to, you know, HIT or to Triple M, and most of the programs are coming from somewhere else.
That's a good point.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's probably, being fair, it's the only thing that you can do being a radio station now to keep earning revenue in the way that you are, you know, in the way that you always used to. But it seems to me, you know, there's so much more choice of radio station, but there's actually far less choice if you are a talented, you know, producer or presenter. And I was neither of those things. But if you have that talent, there's nowhere for you to go other than, of course, to podcasting, which is great.
Well, speaking of talent and where you went with your career, you spoke about coming to Australia for love. Nice, love story there that someone should turn into a podcast. I've got here, I can map out where you've gone from working, you know, you obviously did Pulse FM, you originally worked at Virgin Radio. I think you started one of the original podcasts there. You then moved to the BBC, as any good Englishman would, in that industry.
It's the law.
It's the law, yeah. Working on what was then the iPlayer, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got that period of your life, and then you've got this life in Australia where now you're a consultant. You've worked with the likes of the ABC, Seven News, West Media. You've got Pod News, media.info. Piece the parts where you go from here, life in Australia, completely living off what you do there, between your sort of last few gigs in the UK. What was the sort of stepping stones with that?
Well, So one of the things that I had done is, as you say, after leaving working at radio in Yorkshire, I went down to London. It was in the middle of the dot-com boom, and I was running a website which is called Media Info now, but was called Media UK then. You can probably see why I had to change the name. And that was something that was earning, enough money for me to kind of live off just.
Yeah.
And it was right at the beginning of the dot-com boom. And so a company said, why don't you come and work with us? My partner at the time wanted to change jobs anyway. Why don't you come and work with us? We will take the code, and we will help you with making this website that you have into a much more profitable thing, and then sell it. That was basically the idea. And it was a company, a software development company that basically worked for telecoms company, mobile phone company.
Yeah. It's sort of equivalent to, not Telstra, but TPG.
The equivalent of that was a smaller one, but the equivalent of that sort of thing. And they did all of the billing software for that telephone company. and so they thought, we've got these really good software developers. We have a sort of an up and down thing in terms of the amount of work that our client is asking us to do. And so what Media UK or Media Info is now could do is we can actually take the same software that we're working on for somebody else and actually work during our downtime for Media UK to make the software better etc. So it was a clever plan, and it was at exactly the right time, except when it very, very quickly wasn't, because two things happened. Firstly, the dot-com boom stopped booming, which was a bit of a mistake. And then secondly, the telecoms company that the company was doing the billing for turned around and said, we don't want you anymore. And wow. So all of a sudden, one company based in the centre of London with, 20 developers, all of a sudden thought, we have no customers anymore. And so they went bust. And so, I remember going... I remember going one night and going, this is a little bit embarrassing. I have, the only thing that I have, which is earning me money at the moment, is this media website. What am I going to do with it? Because it's on a box. It's on a literal, actual server in a rack somewhere. I need to get it, and I need to keep running this website. But I don't own the box, and I don't own the, blah, blah, blah. So anyway,
oh my God.
Very late at night one night, a friend of mine and me went into the internet hosting company, who we had friends at anyway, and picked the box up and went home.
Wow.
And plugged it into my internet connection at home and just hoped that it would carry on running, and it did. So I was able to keep that company going.
Oh my God.
Even though, everything else had sort of fallen down. I had to rewrite everything, but
How long was it between
a fun old experience
between that until you could move it to, say, AWS? And so, how many years?
Oh, I mean, years and years. So literally that website for a full year or so was running on a laptop that was underneath my stairs at home at the end of an ADSL line. But it worked, and I was able to actually keep the thing running enough to then go to it's a company called Fanatical Support. Who are they? Robert Scobel worked for them for a while.
Really?
Red, what were they called? Rackspace.
Oh, so Rackspace. Yeah.
So I ended up buying a Rackspace box, which is hugely expensive, and running it off there for some time, and that kind of worked. And then eventually AWS came along, and you know, and my hosting costs went down and down and down. So that was helpful. But by that point, I'd made the decision to go and work for I worked for Virgin Radio for 5 or 6 years.
Okay.
First. And worked at the BBC for 2 years. Yes. And then left the BBC in 2009. I don't think I was quite ready to work for the world's largest broadcaster, having worked for very small companies in the past. You know, working for the world's largest broadcaster is a bit difficult.
Yeah. I could imagine just a little bit bureaucratic, just a bit. Yeah. Slightly, a little bit political in a 20,000 headcount organization.
Yeah. So, I mean, the way that I used to talk about it at the time was that, you know, you know when you go and you watch a play?
Okay.
You go and you watch a play and everybody's brilliant and the orchestra's great and they play in time and everything and all of the actors know their lines and it's, you know, and the lights work and everything and it's just brilliant. And then you work for that play. You work behind the scenes and you realize that the leading man and the leading lady hate each other and, you know, she's having an affair with this guy and this person's an alcoholic and the orchestra, you know, that person is never there in the orchestra and blah, blah, blah. And you realize that what you get to see when you're sitting in the audience is a very different view to what you get to see once you're actually working behind the scenes.
Uh-huh.
And that was very much my experience at the BBC. And I think, being fair, that's the experience that you get if you're working in, you know, middle management or senior management. That's the sort of experience that you get there. If you are further down, then you're actually, you know, management's job is to shield your talent from that, which is something that I hope I did quite well during my time there.
So you're a manager there?
Yeah, so I was looking after, I think at one point I was looking after 76 developers.
Jesus.
On their websites. And some incredibly intelligent people and some really good people there. But my goodness, the politics nearly killed me. So
you left the BBC. You had media.info for a while now.
Hmm.
Where did Pod News come into it?
So I started working as a radio consultant and I still go and talk at lots of conferences across the world and helping companies about what the future is and where the future is going in terms of radio. And I went to the Worldwide Radio Summit, which is a thing that happens every year in Los Angeles. And I kind of joke in that it's a bit like, you know, Worldwide Radio Summit is as worldwide as the worldwide, you know, baseball championships are. It's not that worldwide, but nevertheless, there are a few people that come from overseas. And I was chatting with a friend of mine in the bar after the first day. And we were talking about podcasting, and he said, you know what really annoys me is an American friend of mine, what really annoys me is there's nowhere to go to get news about podcasting. There's plenty of places to go about radio,
okay,
but there's nowhere to go to get news about podcasting.
And what year was this?
And that was 2015.
Okay, all right.
And so I thought... well, that's interesting. And I've been kind of doing something around this, around, you know, the future of radio as a newsletter for a while. So I understand how that bit works. I understand how the internet works. I understand how podcasting works. Maybe this is something for me. And so about 3 months later, I'd done a few trial runs in terms of workflow to work out when I could fit it into my day, because that's an important part of doing this.
Yeah.
And working out what the quickest way of doing it could be. because I'd already learned from Media Info that the way that you can produce great value isn't to write to rewrite press releases as articles. That's a mug's game, but is to actually, you know, do link, you know, link out to places to help people find the news. And you are compiling essentially a links list every day.
Yeah, which is what we were chatting about before we started recording. That's, I think, the real value in it.
Yeah, because actually, instead of just seeing somebody trying to rewrite a press release and really not adding that much to it, actually linking to the press release or copying and pasting the press release and being really open and honest that that's what you're doing is actually just as valuable, because you're actually, you know, linking somebody to the full amount of detail that that company has given you. And occasionally, yes, by all means, write a full article about X, Y, and Z that's going on. But your main focus is to curate that list of things which are going on that you should know about.
Yeah.
So I sat there and I sort of played around with the timings, worked out what would work for me in terms of a daily newsletter, and then put that live at the end of May in 2015.
May 2015. And how long after that did the podcast come along?
And so the podcast, I mean, you know, people were saying Pod News, so it's a podcast, right? And I was saying, no, it's a newsletter. And they said, why don't you make it into a podcast? And I was thinking, well, A, because that would be a lot of work. And B, because it's a links list. It's a list literally linking out to interesting stories that I have found that day. You can't really make that into a podcast. Well, it turns out you can. But it's just, it's a slightly different experience. And so the point of the podcast is to direct people to the newsletter, is to remind people that the newsletter exists. It's another touch point out to people. And it is there. It's a 2-minute news briefing. It's available on, you know, smart speakers, which actually is where quite a lot of the traffic comes from.
Really? Which speaker in particular at the moment?
Both Google and Amazon, but Google Google more so, I think. But yeah, you know, and so it sits there as something which is reminding people that the newsletter exists, helping people find the newsletter in a different, you know, in a different experience. And again, you know, I mean, it comes from my radio days of talking to radio people and saying, you have some great content. You need to really get the most amount of value out of this content. So don't just broadcast it once.
Yeah.
Broadcast it more than once. Stick it online. Do a transcript. Send the transcript out to the local press. Do as much as you can if you've got some great content that you actually have there. And so I'm hopefully doing a bit of that for myself.
I think so. I think, you know, an example with ours, like, you know, you gotta document as much as possible. And I remember we had one of the gentlemen, Courtney from Nearly Media, on. He was talking about the fact that you've got to get the video, you've got to get audio, create promo clips and all that sort of stuff. I think that's really what major media organizations and the best creators do really, really, really well. They create that sort of pinnacle, you know, like a pyramid in a way, that base, and then things that spread up beneath that. Which is really
important. It's massively important. I mean, if you think of a radio, station of, you know, Hamish and Andy being a great experience of some really good Australian former radio presenters, but nevertheless radio presenters. And you look at what they did, and yes, they made a great radio show every single afternoon, but they also made great social media content that they shared. They made great experiences, which you could actually, you know, use in different ways. You know, it was a really good example of something that everything would pull you back to the radio show, but there was lots of other stuff there as well. And I think, you know, anybody that can make the most out of the content that they have and get the best value out of it, you know, is really important. Yeah.
If you think about your day to day, what does that, like, what does the process look like for curating something like Pod News? Are you literally sitting there consuming media throughout the day amongst other obligations you may have, like the talk that you've got to do, I think, tomorrow? Or, you know, how do you sort of look at that breakdown of work?
Yeah, so I mean, it really depends. But one of the things that I worked on with PodNews when I was sort of, you know, having a play and seeing, will this actually fly as a thing, was what can I do to make my workflow as simple and straightforward as possible? And I'm lucky in that I can code.
Okay.
And so the website itself is my own code.
That's good.
So I can actually then go, what is possible? What am I able to do? So as a case in point, if you read the PodNews newsletter, mm-hmm. at the bottom of the PodNews newsletter, virtually every day are a list of new podcasts or podcasts which are in the news in some way, shape, or form. And there's a little square of the artwork of that podcast there. And there's a link that leads you off to a podcast page so that you can subscribe on whatever it is that you want to subscribe to and blah, blah, blah. And all of that is laid out in a particular way for that section of the newsletter. I don't do any of that. I literally
really?
Link to a podcast and my code goes, oh, he's linked to this podcast. I'll go and I'll get the artwork and I'll put it here. I'll go and I'll get this and I'll put, you know, so all of that stuff is all completely automatic so that I can spend less time on producing, on doing the boring, you know, the boring work of you know, layout, and spend more time getting the story and actually being able to produce something which looks as
okay.
you know, simple and straightforward.
And so if we're looking, because I was just reading yesterday's this morning, I love, by the way, how you've got that thing. It's like, this will take you 2.7. I'm guessing you've got some sort of automatic calculation,
yes.
sort of like how Medium's got that.
Yes.
So you, basically where you spend your time, the audience probably can't see this, but is on the bulk of those dot points there before it gets to the classified sort of section or before it gets to the podcast section?
Well,
that.
So I'm basically, I guess what I'm saying is that I spend my time on the editorial and I don't spend my time on laying it out or making it look pretty, because that's what code is for.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, if you can code, and this would be my tip for anybody that's you know, watching or listening to this, if you can code, that is an amazing skill that you have that you need to really make the most of. And so I write every edition of PodNews into a text editor. I use a thing called Markdown, which is just an easy way of adding links so that I never have to touch a mouse. I'm just writing stuff. I never have to worry about, you know, I need to highlight this word and then find the bold button and do all of that stuff. No, because, you know, you just use Markdown. It's really quick and really, really simple. All of the adding of the... So I made some mistakes when I started taking sponsorship. I made some mistakes of occasionally forgetting to put the sponsor in. And I thought, this is a mistake. And then I thought, but I'm a coder. And so now my system will literally not let me send the newsletter if I haven't put a sponsor there or if I haven't uploaded the podcast, which I also host myself.
Uh-huh.
It literally says, nah, I'm not doing it because you haven't uploaded the podcast yet.
Wow.
And so just getting all of those little bits of code in there has really saved myself an awful lot of time. So to answer the question, I can put, I don't want to, but I can put an entire day's worth of PodNews together in 45 minutes. But typically I'm spending, you know, 3 or 4 hours at it. And
yeah.
part of that is going into Facebook, going into Reddit, going into Twitter and actually seeing what people are talking about, because that's a tremendous way of getting some idea of what the buzz is and what the new stories are that you won't find on an RSS reader and you won't find from emails from, you know, PR companies. And PR companies will hate me for saying this, but quite a lot of the time I will only read your emails if I don't have enough news.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think you know? That process as well is what prevents piss poor performance and is a reason why people read it, because all that preparation goes into giving, like, you don't have to go, oh geez, what am I going to put in there? You already know, you've already got in your own head, well, what would I want to read, what was interesting today, and then just goes in
yeah.
there.
Yeah, and I use Google Keep an awful lot, which is basically I will just share anything that I'm that I see which is interesting. I'll go, all right, copy that into Google Keep for later, and then when I sit down to write the newsletter up, it's just I open Google Keep and there are 20 stories, and I then work out which I'm going to actually keep.
Yeah. Well, look, as I was saying earlier, I think it's probably if anyone has a podcast or is interested in the space of audio, let's call it radio, podcasts, voice-based platforms, I think you've got to have Pod News in there because I was saying before, I've got four at the moment. I've got Value Investing World, which is really your investing finance, Pod News, the DigiDay video briefing, and then Tim Ferriss's weekly mailer as well.
I mean, if you're you know, bored enough about the future of radio, then I would also recommend my Radio Trends newsletter, which is at james.crid.land.
I didn't even know that
existed. Which looks vaguely familiar to Pod News. I can't think why that might be, but anyway, but james.crid.land is something that I do every week. I do a newsletter which is just interesting things that I have spotted about the future of radio.
Okay.
But, you know, it's there because I have that interest, and I still do an awful lot of talking about it and an awful lot of working with broadcasters as well. So it's useful to keep me up to speed with what's going on in that area too.
Back on the point of process, you were talking before about specific pieces of software that you're using, TextEditor. I know you use Hindenburg for actually editing the episode. I found it interesting looking at some of your talks, and you were looking. I think you were demonstrating a product called Script Editor. It might have been some sort of where you could take out ums and ahs and stuff like that.
Yeah, so I've demonstrated a product which I think is called Spext in the past, but now you won't see that anymore. You will see a demonstration of a piece of software called Descript, which does much the same sort of thing, but is actually really cool and really smart. And I edited, you know, to your point about trying things out, I edited the Pod News podcast with it a couple of weeks a couple of months ago, where again it was a word processor. You could go in, you could just edit out, you know, sentences that you didn't want in the podcast. It would transcribe everything automatically for you. You could add music, you could do editing. It's a really good little tool.
And do you still use it today at all?
I used it once okay. for that. I am old enough to have, you know, initially edited on reel-to-reel tape, so I know my way around an editor, and so I'm quite happy with that. But, but you know, there are these wonderful tools out there which mean that actually if you want to make a great podcast, you don't necessarily need to learn how, you know, Adobe Audition works anymore. You can just actually focus on just telling a story, and that's the most important thing.
Well, that's one of the things that I guess intrigues me. I think we'll get into that in a moment because one of the points I want to talk about is production still, but is these business models which are sort of arising in this space. But before we come to that, you know, one of the things that we were asked frequently when we were sort of grabbing at questions and just speaking to other people that were in the industry, you know, you see a lot of high quality podcast shows, you report on a lot of different things. I mean, for us personally, we're sort of one of those middling podcasts, the sort of top 20 percentile. But you know how like the top 1% are really the ones who get all the revenue, the majority of the audience, so on and so forth. So, you know, a show like ours may have 4,000 unique listeners, but a Joe Rogan of the world might have 100,000 as an example.
Yes.
I guess I was curious, what do you think takes those podcasts from sort of a middling podcast to a top podcast? Is it all elements of production, audience, time, things like that? I guess I was just curious to hear your thoughts seeing the industry as it is.
I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, Joe Rogan is a great example, is somebody who, you know, we forget has spent 10 years being a stand-up comedian, learning his craft, learning his skill.
He's on TV.
Yeah, exactly. And so he ends up having all of that stuff Whereas, you know, a lot of podcasters don't have that. A lot of podcasters also don't necessarily have the consistency that somebody like that has. You know, Mark Maron, you know, again, very consistent, but yes, has a lot of back history in the other things that he has done. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we kind of forget about. We assume that it's easy to make great audio. We assume that it's easy to then reach audiences, which is a whole new different, you know, thing. And I think that's one of the things, you know, if there's a big difference with radio and podcasting, it's that podcasting, you can tell a story just as you can with radio. But you don't have a captive audience with podcasting. I used to be very lucky when I was doing the evening show, for example. I was taking over from somebody who was doing the afternoon show who was quite good. And all of the audience that he had got was then given to me. That doesn't happen in terms of a podcast. You start every single podcast from zero listeners.
Yeah.
And you have to build up every single podcast. And the way that you do that, you know, is by a mixture of consistency, making sure that people know what they're going to get when they listen. Oh, and by the way, people don't like beige stuff. People like things with opinion. people like things which are different. So, you know, so try not to be too beige and try and be a bit more colorful. But also it comes down to marketing. It comes down to branding. It comes down to just your tenacity in building this. But, as well, I mean, lots of people found me and found Pod News, the newsletter, because Dave Jackson did an interview with me, after I'd been going for about 3 or 4 months. And Dave has a tremendous amount of followers. And it was a great, and I didn't know who Dave Jackson was. And it was a great thing to be on his show because all of a sudden loads more people found me.
Yeah.
And now I've got something where, because I'm geeky and I can do it, I've got alerts now on my mobile phone every time somebody subscribes, which is quite a scary thing because you're then sitting and you're watching and you're going, oh, that's another person.
Hey, so, how are you getting these notifications? Is it like a push notification?
So I've patched them into the company's Slack profile. And
oh, my God.
And so it sits there and tells me every time things happen on the website, and a subscription is part of those. And, you know, and it is fascinating. And I noticed, you know, a couple of weeks ago, all of a sudden that there were loads of people from Spotify email addresses who all of a sudden have clearly found what Pod News is all about. And they've started, getting it. And you're there thinking, oh, that's interesting. I should focus on that a little bit more and blah, blah, blah.
That is a good segue to the business of this industry, which... Mm. You know, Spotify has been a fascinating one. We saw your little article the other day, the link to the article rather, about creating playlists on Spotify. And we've just slowly noticed the growth in the audience that is on Spotify. Mm. I want to touch on the point of discovery in future because that is a really good point. It's very, very hard to do. I mean, for us, the biggest thing that we've had for discovery is obviously social media, but filming video. Video has made it a real thing. People know that we're people and that we exist. We're not just some voice that's there that they're subscribed. That's when it really started to rocket off, so to speak. The business model, though, I mean, I read a really interesting piece from the VC firm Andreessen Horowitz, commonly known as A16Z in the tech industry. And they largely spoke about the fact
that... I think you'll find it's A16Z.
A16Z, sorry, apologies. I know a lot of, you know, the Gary V's, the Gary Vaynerchuk's of the world talk about this voice-first sort of movement in computing. They're talking about things like player models versus vertical integration models, like a sort of Himalaya or Pocket Cast versus a sort of Calm meditation app. You've spoken about how speakers and headphones and home devices are sort of, you just want to basically get there. Interesting little stat, I think you mentioned that 9 out of 10 people still listen to audio in the morning, which is good. And that also 7 to 24 podcasts as the average has sort of increased just a little bit, so to speak, in the last few years. What do you see as the key sort of future probabilities happening in this space and really sort of opening it up to a more broad demographic?
Mm. Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of change which is going on right now. So you look at the amount of change with Spotify. So, so as we record this tomorrow, I'm going to speak at OzPod, which is a big Australian podcast conference.
It's the bee's knees of conferences.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a great look into the Australian podcast, industry, and so I've been putting together some stats for that, and the amount of podcasts that have been consumed by Spotify has gone up by a third in just a year, which is good. Australians are actually listening to more podcasts on Spotify by comparison to other platforms. So actually, you know, Spotify is really interesting because I think for podcasters like us, what we don't really want is we don't want one company running them. We don't want one company in charge of podcasting. And we've kind of had that in the past through Apple, but the whole world of RSS has kept it open and has kept it free for the Pocket Casts of this world and, you know, Overcast and, you know, whoever else, for you to be able to, you know, innovate. And now where we're coming to is Apple is having less and less influence. So below 60% of podcasts are now consumed through Apple Podcasts. Spotify is about 12%, so it's in a very commanding second place.
Yeah, and growing fast.
And growing very fast. And then you've got all of the other podcast platforms, which are still actually end up making quite a lot of, you know, numbers, you know, under the hood, you know, as well. So you've got that going on. You've got, which is great news because actually it means that Apple can't, you know, all of a sudden decide to throw everybody off who's from Australia because they don't like Australians anymore, for example. There's nothing to stop Apple from doing that, but at least you know, you've now got all of these other platforms which are up and running, which can actually, you know, stop Apple from thinking about doing that sort of thing in the future. So you've got that going on, which is helpful, but you've also got, you know, just a large number of different surfaces, I call them, for listening to podcasts. So you've got smart speakers, which are still tiny for podcasters, but the numbers have doubled in the last year.
Yeah.
So you've got smart speakers, but you've also got, you know, podcasts are in Spotify, they're in Deezer, they're in Pandora in the US. You can now listen to podcasts while you're flying with Qantas, with Virgin Australia, with British Airways. Nobody should fly with British Airways. With all of these various things. So you can listen to podcasts in planes. You can listen to podcasts in your hotel room when you check into a Hilton hotel in the US. You can actually, you know, it's got this wonderful iHeartRadio thing inside with all of the podcasts in there. You can listen to podcasts in so many different ways now. Then actually that's really exciting. And only 2-3 years ago, we were talking about, well, frankly, Apple Podcasts and that's it, because Google hadn't even, you know, sorted anything out there. And I mean, arguably, they haven't sorted anything
out. They still haven't, really.
But the amount of podcasts played through Google has doubled in the last year. And the amount of visibility that Google is giving podcasts is tremendously up, because all of a sudden podcasts are now appearing in Google search, and that's a massive thing. They might not listen to them through Google search. I don't care. The fact that they are actually seeing them appear in a Google search result is really important, because there are 83,000 Google searches done every single second. And if podcasts can appear there, well, great. You know, so I think we're seeing a tremendous amount of different surfaces of where people are consuming podcasts and seeing podcasts, you know, in a very visible way. That's great news. And we're seeing, thankfully, we're seeing other contenders to Apple's throne of the company that is running podcasts, which means that Apple can't run podcasts. And ideally, we would be at a situation where we have three large companies, all with 30% market share, and then a bunch of scrappy folk having fun as well for the remaining 10%. But that would be our ideal. At the moment, we've still got Apple with 60%.
Yeah.
We've got Spotify with about 12% now. Everybody else is about 3-1%. But, you know, that's actually beginning to be a little bit more healthy, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, when we just actually moved to Simplecast, actually the thing that gave me the push was your review of Simplecast. You know, we were using an AWS setup prior. Absolute
yes.
Fucking nightmare. I remember reading your review of that, talking about if you have large files, don't be doing this. And I'm just thinking in my head, yes.
Yes.
Yes, don't be doing this. Because it costs us something like 150 Aussie per month. It's something outrageous in comparison to what we're paying.
Don't host yourself. Basically, don't host yourself.
Yeah.
And the reason why I host myself is that I don't want to write a nasty story about the hosting company which I've chosen and for them to then kick me off the next day.
It's a very unique scenario.
Obviously, I don't want that, but yes. But for virtually everybody else, don't host yourself. You know, go with, I'm on the advisory board of Captivate, so I should say go with Captivate, but go with anybody you like, but don't host yourself.
No, do not do that at all.
And don't host with SoundCloud as well.
Yeah, SoundCloud is horrible.
it's not a podcast host.
Simplecast is amazing.
Yeah, Simplecast's great. Really good.
The geolocation is really, really good. That's the big thing. I just feel like my stats are way more accurate now, and that was the big thing I noticed. We went from like 95% iTunes to 72% iTunes.
Mm.
But it's also the other apps that have arisen from that. Could also be as well. The previous thing that we were using was we used sort of like a wrapper of I've just blanked on that. It starts with P.
Podtrac.
We're using Podtrac over the top of our own inbuilt RSS feed. And it just wasn't really, like I said, iPhone platform. You couldn't actually tell what people were using because it's, you know, there's all these feeder platforms. But Simplecast is amazing. And it's really interesting to see that number of iTunes come down. And it just had me thinking before when we were chatting about Spotify, like, what is that? And it's probably a good segue to Discovery. What does that do for Discovery? Because in Spotify, I was just trialing it out recently as I moved from Apple Music and, you know, there's the advertising element. Can you advertise to people who are, you know, like to a younger audience who aren't using the premium version?
So I think one of the things that Spotify is great at is that it gives you demographic stats on your listeners. So you can actually tell how many are boys and girls, what sort of age group they are, even what music they're into. Because obviously Spotify has that data and they share it with you on the Spotify Podcasters portal. So that is great data that you literally cannot get anywhere else. So Apple don't share any of that information, whereas Spotify, you know, shares a bunch of that. So that's great and really useful stuff. And what both Apple and Spotify will share is how long people get through your podcast, which bits they fast forward through, which bits they, you know, they don't, you know, where they just leave, and all of that stuff that is tremendous data. And so using that data, not as overall numbers, because neither Apple or Spotify can tell you your overall numbers, but actually using that data in conjunction with the overall numbers that you have through Simplecast is a really helpful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of, you know, looking at that. But, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, I wouldn't necessarily worry too much about your numbers, because at the end of the day, actually, what really matters is, are you producing fantastic content?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's really
that
important. And, you know, it's as many people say, you know, your numbers won't get any bigger if you just sit and look at them.
it's a good point. I agree with that. I still don't. I mean, when you're in the lower bounds, I don't think it really matters. Like, and particularly if you're not, we don't take advertising. We've been approached many a times to take advertising, and I don't think we ever will, because the thing that funds this is an agency. And so really this becomes brilliant networking, a way of meeting interesting people type of tool. It's not for us something that
that has to be monetized, so to speak. So I agree, and I think a lot of people really get stuck on that. You've got to sort of look for, like when I first started doing this, I was like, all right, I'm going to do 8, and on that basis, I just want to get better at speaking to people. That's it. And it continued because some people liked it. And then now here we are. I'm sitting with the man whose newsletter I read every day. On that point of discovery, I mentioned before apps like, I think it's pronounced Zimalaya, but the English version is Himalaya.
Yes.
You got Spotify with their discovery playlist.
By the way, I think it's spelt Zimalaya in China, but it's actually pronounced Himalaya in China as well.
There you go.
Just to massively confuse us.
I was trying to look it up, but I couldn't really work it out. But
yeah.
Anyway, that's sort of a social first platform. You got the playlists. You got, I know you're a fan of Chris's Moonshot Pod, and he's had, he created that bot, which is all about discovery. How do you see things developing for the area of discovering new forms of audio and podcasts and whatnot?
Well, I think there's some really interesting stuff coming out there. There's an app called Swoot, which is much like Twitter in that you are following people and you can then see what podcasts they're listening to and that sort of thing. There's another one called Breaker. And Breaker is, again, a very social discovery app, which, again, is doing that sort of thing. If you're old enough to remember Last.fm, Last.fm used to do this for music. And both of these apps are doing that sort of thing for podcasting, where you can see what your friends are listening to and what people who you're following are listening to, what they're recommending, what they're commenting on. Podchaser has also started doing a social feed.
Yeah.
And they're a good Australian company. And that, again, is sort of showing, you know, the social graph, if you like, of podcasting. I think from my point of view, that means that we have 3 social graphs, and I think we should only have one. And so I keep on talking to each of these individually and going, you guys should talk.
Or get together in some form.
That would be really good. I think that there's that sort of stuff going on. That said, you know, the ABC's figures that they released at OzPod actually end up showing that there are a lot of people who are listening to new podcasts. And the reason why they're listening to new podcasts is because of word of mouth, which is the number one recommendation tool. But the number two recommendation tool is recommendations from podcasts. Because we kind of forget, don't we, that podcasting is a very intimate medium. People actually listen to what we say in podcast. And so if I was to recommend a podcast and tell you to go and listen to that podcast, then quite a few people would, you know. So we should use that. What I'm saying, OzPod is we should recommend more podcasts in our own podcasts to continue to raise our industry, to make sure that, more people are consuming more podcasts, because that's a really important thing as well. And so, you know, the more of that sort of sharing the love that we can actually do, the better for the industry long term as well. So, advertising and all that stuff is great. I know that there's advertising for podcasting trams, you know, here in Melbourne. I walked past an ad in the bus stop in Brisbane the other day for a podcast. All of that is absolutely fine and dandy, but the lowest hanging fruit is to advertise to podcast listeners about what other podcasts they could also go and have a listen to.
I like that. I should chat to some fellow podcasters about that, and we should
And that's one of the benefits of a podcast network, of course, is that you can actually do that throughout your network. Or one of the other things, you know, so the ABC has got together with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the CBC, and regularly do cross-promotions. And that's both cross-promotions of trails and cross-promotions of actual full episodes, so that you end up hearing a different podcast that your trusted guide is recommending you. And that, to me, makes so much sense. And that's what, you know, radio has always excelled in, and what podcasting has always excelled in terms of advertising. Why aren't we doing that in terms of great podcasts that we love as well?
Yeah, I really like that. I think there's going to be all sorts of efforts, but I think little things like that are going to be very useful. And you've got me intrigued now about your actual talk at Ozpod and wondering whether it's going to be recorded. In some way, because in the past at Ozpod, they've recorded certain talks and I like watching them in hindsight.
Yes, and I hope that they are recording them. I think that they are.
Yeah.
I think that they are. They're not streaming it live, but I think that they're recording it. But in any case, if you do a search at podnews.net for Ozpod, all one word, then you will find my talk. Because by the time you're listening to this, I will have posted it on Podnews. There may be audio there. There may not be, but there will certainly be all of the slides and everything else. So,
good, because I'm going to be heading to Japan. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Japan is a different and very foreign place.
It's a weird place. I remember you were doing a talk and you were speaking about that. And I was like, I feel like there's travel before and after Japan.
Yes.
It's just such a strange, strange place. This is sort of our third time now in the space of 2 years. We've actually got quite a few interviews going on there as well. So, it should be very interesting.
Wow.
Before we get into some rapid-fire questions to finish off, I guess I was curious as to what is the business model of James Cridlin, the futurologist, the radio futurologist, rather, even though I know you were speaking about that Lord Kelvin incident and how being dubbed a futurologist per se is not the best of things to be doing.
The only reason why I call myself a radio futurologist, as I fairly often say, is that if you can print your own business cards, you can literally call yourself anything.
You literally can.
When I worked at the BBC, it turned out that the way that you printed business cards there is you went onto their intranet and you were given a form and you typed out in the form what you wanted your business cards to say, and then they turned up. And I was there thinking, this is a tremendously trusting thing to do. I could write myself down as anything. Managing Director of the World.
What did you put in there?
The
role?
No, I just put my boring title.
I'm wondering if you put, it would have been funny if you put something in there.
Ridiculous long title as well. It was longer than the business card.
What does the future look like for the futurologist?
Well, so I think, the world of radio, which used to be, the thing that I worked in, has changed phenomenally over the last couple of years. So it's very much changed from being a lot of different companies to being, one of two or three companies in every country. They run all of the radio stations. So what typically you end up with then is you end up with the world of a consultant who goes in and helps radio companies. Either you're really, really big and you're really good and you go in and you help one of the top three companies, or you have to choose from... you go in like, for example, like me, I will, Southern Cross or Stereo don't want to hear from me because they have really good people who know what the future is and they're programming for that. And I may or may not agree with that, but that's all fine. Whereas you've then got very much smaller broadcasters that don't really know what the future is going to be, but also they can't do much about it. And in any case, they probably can't afford me. Mm-hmm. So you've got this sort of, if you look of the Venn diagram of potential clients, that Venn diagram is quite small for any consultant in any role, by the way, but particularly when you have a look at how media has consolidated. So I love radio. I'm not going to wave radio goodbye, but certainly in terms of where the future is, clearly for independent producers, for where opportunities are, there are clear opportunities in the podcast space, and that is, I think, what I'm very excited about. If you look at podcasting, is that there aren't the gatekeepers. There aren't the Southern Cross Stereos and the ARNs and the Nova Entertainments of this world, who are basically in charge of the transmitters, and they're the people stopping you from getting as far as that. Anybody, literally anybody, can do a podcast and can get it onto the same platform that the ABC are on and that, you know, CBS are on and the New York Times are on. And that is a tremendously exciting thing and virtually unique in the world of media.
You're right.
It's a tremendously exciting place because it means that literally anybody can compete with anybody else. And that's what I don't think that radio understands. And if radio do understand that, so iHeartRadio, for example, kind of understand that, which is why they're trying to get people to use their own app rather than Apple's app or Overcast or Pocket Casts, because they can control their own app. But my suspicion is that people are, you know, the genie is out of the bottle here, and people are a bit more savvy now in terms of understanding that they can get all of the great podcasts that they really enjoy by not going down a proprietary solution and actually going for something which is open, which weirdly Apple is. Because if you think about it, that's a really weird thing for Apple to be as open as it currently is.
Exactly.
But you've also got, you know, obviously anybody that consumes RSS feeds, you know, has access to all of this stuff.
It's such a valuable point. I mean, we've had that with a prior guest, Luke and Lewis. They had the Luke and Lewis show on Fox. They were on Sundays and they moved to weeknights. Then they went back to Sundays. And basically they were told, because they're comedians, and they were told, well, you've got to go to Shepparton to do breakfast, or this is what you have to do until, like, you know, whoever's on Drive or Breakfast here locally, which we've got a contract with them for 3 years.
Yeah.
And so the radio network was like, well, obviously you're going to pick us, right? And they were like, well, then, you know, they obviously left and they just started laughing. Like, why would we do that? And so now they've started their own show and they're doing a lot better because they have the audience. They've got direct access to advertisers.
Well, but this is one of the difficulties I think that radio has.
Yeah.
In that, if you are young talent with some really good ideas about what you can do, then either you go to a radio station who will take all of your intellectual property, who will control it, who will do all of these kinds of things, or you can turn around and go, I'm going to do it myself, and I'm going to do something on YouTube or do something on podcasting. And by the way, the most popular place where Germans consume podcasts is YouTube. So so it's probably both. So go to as many of these places as you possibly can and do your shtick there rather than go to a gatekeeper, because the gatekeeper might be able to give you a bit of audience as radio companies and TV companies can, but they are also very creatively controlling.
And also that you build a real audience, like you notice the difference, and you get direct feedback from that audience. Like, I've noticed the difference between people who come from a mainstream media background and interviewing them, and the lack of response in their episode into someone, say, in comparison, like yourself or the Luke and Lewis's of the world, who actually have an engaged audience in their respective medium.
I mean, I'd say, you know, I mean, I so when I was on the radio a long, long time ago, I used to, I did this whole thing of, it's the 10th of March, just 8 days until my birthday. If you haven't bought me a birthday present, there's still time. Here's the address to send it to. You know, completely taking the piss. But I thought, you know, this might be a way of getting some free stuff. And it was. And people sent me free stuff. But then the next year, I just handed in my resignation. I wasn't going to keep my contract going. I didn't know whether or not I'd still be on the air on my birthday. So I didn't mention it at all. Now, this is 1994, so this is way back in the days when we didn't have electronic diaries or anything like that. So in 1994, people would have copied one diary into another diary. And I got in on the day of my birthday to do my show, which I was still doing. I went to have a look at my post box in the station to see if I'd got any post. And I had got some post. I'd got four birthday cards from listeners. Four birthday cards from people that had never met me. And the only connection they had with me was I was the guy who was a bit beige, who was saying, this is the, you know, this is, that was, you're listening to this radio station. What, you know, here's the time. Here's another three in a row. And literally that was the only connection they had, but they felt connected enough to copy from one diary to a next when my birthday was, and to then spend £3 in buying a card and sending something in. And you suddenly realize audio, and it's audio, it's not radio, it's audio, can do so much because it's such an intimate medium.
Yeah.
And the big difference, by the way, between radio and podcasting is radio, 50% of people are listening with other people. So when you're listening to the radio, typically you'll probably, you know, one out of two of us are listening with other people. For podcasting, that number is 90% are listening alone.
Wow.
So virtually everybody who's listening to this won't have anybody else in the car, won't have anybody else in the house who's listening to this, which, by the way, is why podcasts don't do very well on smart speakers.
Huh.
Because they're piping this sound into their ears and they're listening in a really, really intimate way. And they are actually listening as opposed to the radio, where quite a lot of the time it's on as background noise. So there's a real difference. And that intimacy is incredibly powerful if we use it well.
Yeah. And I 100% agree with that, that intimate connection that you get with people, that, you know, you've spoken in the past about that human shared connection. I notice that when I jump onto Instagram on a, you know, a couple of times a week, and someone will message me and say, you know, I'll just get some random message about how they love this episode or over email or whatever. And I'm like, wow, like, and then, you know, every now and then I'll catch up with a few of them and, and, you know, I say, oh, I've got this thing coming up, and they're like, oh yeah, I know, you're going to Japan to do this and that. And that, I'm like, I know. Wow.
It's quite scary.
But it's also amazing.
I'll tell you what, it's also scary when you bump into people and they say, do you remember when in 1997 you were on the radio and you said,
oh,
no,
God.
I don't remember. I don't remember that at
but
all.
I do. I
yes.
love it.
It's the, great, isn't
you know,
it?
It's why we do what we do, right?
Yeah.
We love that human connection.
Human connection and shared experience is an incredible thing, yeah. Yeah.
The rapid fire questions.
Here we go.
Got to ask you, morning routine, what does that look like?
Oh, the morning routine is normally stopping the dog from eating the doona, followed by getting my daughter ready for school and walking down and walking down to school, and then having a cup of coffee. I'm lucky enough in that I have a really good coffee shop, really little neighbourhood coffee shop at the bottom of our road.
Beautiful,
and it's just fantastic. And so that is my morning routine.
And what about the evening? How do you sort of decompress at night?
Well, Pod News goes out, the benefit of the time zone that we have here is that Pod News goes out at 9 o'clock at night here.
Okay.
And so therefore, quite often my evening routine is, oh shit, I haven't written Pod News yet. So there's quite a lot of that goes on. But I will occasionally, I've watched very little television, but of the television I watch, Sean McAuliffe, anything that he does has to be watched. Who's an Australian comedian, for those of you who don't know. Find his stuff on YouTube. And also, quite a lot of the time, I will just sit and watch YouTube videos. And there is, so there's a YouTube video by a guy called, and I'm trying to remember his name, and I'm desperately failing at this point.
What's the sort of topic?
The topic is he's an electrician.
Okay.
He lives in the Isle of Man.
Okay.
And he basically, it's called .com Clive is his YouTube channel. And he takes things apart to find out how they work.
I love this.
And I find it absolutely fascinating. And, you know, the last one that I saw, he was taking apart an LED light and he was explaining how the circuitry works inside. And I don't really understand anything about electronics, but I find it really interesting, just sort of taking stuff apart. And the fact that this guy is taking stuff apart, which means that I don't have to, is probably a good thing. And it's just brilliant. And so I will sit quite often and watch that sort of thing or similar. There's also The Lock Picking Lawyer. And
I think I've seen it.
Massively recommend that.
So much fun.
He just basically sits there, and every video that he does is 3 minutes long, and it's the lockpicking lawyer, and he takes apart, and he literally, he goes, you know, I have spent $200 on this, and they say that it can't be broken and it can't be picked, and so let's see if I can. Click, click, click. Oh, look, there you go. I mean, literally, he just, like, opens every single lock within seconds.
Jesus.
And it's astonishing. And you just basically go...
What's the point?
Yeah. What is the point of even locking your house? Because, my goodness, you can literally get into anything within seconds.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I found a lockpicking channel, which I think may be the same one, but I haven't watched it for a long time. And I found that through Mr. Puzzle. This German, Mr. Puzzle,
he
goes and breaks down these super complex puzzles, which are absolutely fascinating. And I've also recently found the Internet Historian, who's an Australian. I'm pretty sure he's Australian. Like, I feel like he's said that, but he remains anonymous for fear of attack, because he basically documents the sort of the propaganda fights between Tumblr and 4chan.
It's
fascinating.
Oh, interesting.
No one knows who he is, but he's hilarious, because he just basically takes the piss out of both groups, and I absolutely love it. It's the one that I got into a real... You know when you get into those really deep wells, and you probably watch like 200 videos in a row over a few days of this channel? So that's been my go-to.
And I'd also recommend Technology Connections, which is a guy who films this in his basement. He looks like the sort of guy who films it in his basement. But it's really good. He basically goes into, you know, the history of LaserDisc, or VHS machines, why VHS video worked the way it did, and all of this kind of stuff. But what he's done with it is he has researched, you know, he's basically researched everything, and he's done a really good job at it. And it's really well done and really cleverly put together. And again, anybody that has the passion, I think, you know, what comes with all of this is it's passion. Passion in whatever you're really into. How can you get that passion to as many people as you possibly can? Mm-hmm. And some really good stuff out there. So that's what I sit and consume rather than sitting and watching whatever you Victorians laughingly call sport.
All right, last question for you.
I'm enjoying that. That was a very good, quick and fast question.
It never, ever becomes quick. What's your 5 favorite non-musical sounds? 5.
5 yeah. favorite non-musical sounds. Wow. I mean, rain on the roof, which I'm not sure I can remember what that sounds like in Queensland, to be honest with you. But anyway, that's one of them, because that's a nice sound.
It's lovely.
I mean, obviously...
Tin roof.
Obviously, you'd have to say, you know, daughter laughing. Obviously, that would have to be in there. And that's an easy one to get past too. What else? The Bing that tells you that the aeroplane is just about to land, that's a good sound.
Recent one as well for you.
Cannot believe how far away Australia is from the rest of the world. Why didn't anybody tell me? That's a good one. Where are we up to? Number 3.
Well, you got 3 in total. You got 2 more.
I used to really like, this is very geeky, but I used to really like... before the days of playing music and sound effects and things on computer, you used to use these things called carts, and they were 8-track cartridges, and you bang them into a player, and then you hit play, and it would play, and then it would fast forward and whiz all the way back to the front. And that's a specific noise that just reminds me of having fun on the radio, which is a long, long time ago.
So you would
never happen again.
You would literally press play to play that noise.
You would press play, and then it would go vzz, 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 vzz. So it would play whatever the jingle was, and then it would fast forward back to the beginning of the because it was a continuous loop. I should probably explain that. It was like a Mobius loop in a car machine. Yeah, it's a really evocative noise. It's a bit like the noise of a modem that people might remember. It's one of those noises that you'll never hear ever again, but it was quite a nice noise back at the time.
Well, for me, it was a big one because I sort of lived through the transition era of tape to CDs.
Yes.
And my grandparents recorded a bunch of so my grandfather was a publisher and he loved like TV shows and radio and all that stuff. So I've watched every Fawlty Towers and Disney movie that he recorded, including the Snappy Tom ads that were in between.
Nice.
So yeah, I've got a fond memory for that sound too.
Yes.
That sort of wee.
Yes. Yes.
It's very, very fast.
Yes.
But in that case, it was obviously for TV. All right, you got one more.
Oh, one more. I was hoping that you'd forget about that. one more.
Surely there's like a transmission type sound or...
Not really. I mean, you know, I mean, obviously when you, when you've worked in audio for a long, long time, you know, I mean, I was saying that, you know, sometimes when these weird people post clips of you on the radio years and years and years ago, and you suddenly listen back to that and you go, oh, wow, you know, and it completely opens up new... you know, completely opens up memories for you. But I'm not actually a particular fan of radio jingles. Otherwise, you know, you'd probably expect me to say, oh, radio jingles. but I'm not a particular fan of that. I'm just wondering what other noise. I mean, maybe the other noise that would sort of, you know, would be fun and would take me back would be some of the text alert noises on my original, you know, iPhone and things like that. I used to have as my text alert one of the phones that I had, I used to have the noise that you hear in French train stations. So, you know, here it might go bing bong, and then you'll get told that, you know, some train has been cancelled. Whereas in France, there's a little tune that's played, and it's a very, very French tune. And as soon as you hear it, you go, I'm in France. And I had that as my ringtone, as my text message number, text message noise. And it was a tremendous, and they still use it. It's the SNCF, a Bing thing, and they make a whole musical. All of their TV ads and their radio ads all use this, made up into a full track and everything else. It's I'm sure you can find it on YouTube.
I'm definitely going to be look, because this is one of my favorite things to do afterwards, is look at things, and obviously Lauren will link it all. But looking up this sort of stuff is fascinating.
Well, you know, I mean, so the sound goes do 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 do. And you know, and here's a massive challenge. I bet you can't manage to find that and then edit it into here, where I then go do 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 do, and then it works.
That would be good though.
Yeah, it would be good though. But it's it's just, and it reminds me of going on holiday and, you know, and standing in Lille station waiting for my train back to the UK, and you
how
know,
quintessentially
blah, blah, blah.
English of you.
Yeah, well, not very quintessentially English, because I've just said I admire something that the French have done.
No, but that's like, so, you know, the old cliche of the pom goes on holiday to France and they both hate each other, but at the end of the trip they realise that they both love each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
My dad's got a partner in his business, and he's from London as well. And it's the same old thing. They go on trips all the time. You get the Eurorail. And yeah, they just whinge about French people, but really,
well, you know, I mean, and to be honest, we won't be able to go, us Brits won't be able to go anywhere in Europe now. So, so it'll be dim and dark history, I would have thought.
All right. Well, look, James, thank you so much for coming in.
It's a great pleasure.
Where can people find you on the interwebs?
Ah, well, podnews.net, obviously, you should go there. You should subscribe. It's free. So that would be a good thing. If you're interested in the future of radio and stuff like that, then james.crid.land is my rather strange website address for that. Just type that in and you can get a weekly newsletter about that. And you'll also find me on Twitter and
LinkedIn.
Well, LinkedIn if you really have to. But Twitter is good. I'm either at James Cridland or at Podnews. And you'll find me there and, you know, virtually everywhere else.
Are you on Instagram these days? No.
I once tried to use Instagram and once tried to pull in data from Instagram into Media Info so that I could do charts of how well radio stations were being talked up on Instagram and on Facebook and on Twitter and blah, blah, blah. And I did all of the code for Facebook and for Twitter, and Instagram spotted me scraping their data and have banned me. And so I can't actually get into Instagram and use Instagram at all. But also, I don't really care. You know, I'm nearly 50. Why would I? It's just kids on there, right?
Yeah, not anymore. It's the most popular platform now, obviously. But the interesting one for me is TikTok. Yeah, people keep saying it's kids on there now, but that'll be the new Instagram in the next 2 to 3 years, which it's interesting to play around. I've had a video that's had 12,000 plus views, and I've hardly do anything on it. Yes. And then other videos that have got like 100. The discovery element is it's like Twitter and Instagram meshed together. That's how I'd call it. But it's very, very interesting.
Yes, but no, I'm not on there. I'm not on there.
It's a pity. I'd love to see you doing some TikToks. That'd be funny. Look, James, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Great pleasure. Thank you for asking.
Cheers. Thank you for making it to the end. Before you run off, subscribe if you enjoyed this episode, or do leave us a rating. For Instagram, go follow us on @uncommon_podcast. For YouTube, search Uncommon Podcast, and don't forget to subscribe if you're watching this video. Also, give us a like or leave a comment on what you thought about the episode. But until next time, thanks so much for listening. This podcast is brought to you by Neural Media. Are you an entrepreneur or marketer who needs help making podcasts, video, or animation? Perhaps you don't have time to manage a freelancer or the budget to deal with an agency. Well, Neural Media can help you with simple and affordable content creation, saving you time and money by taking away the pain of producing that content. To learn more, head to neural.com/media. That's neural.com/media, play around with our pricing, or request a callback directly. Listeners to the show receive a special discount by using the promo code UNCOMMON.